You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Welcome back to Dear Science for the Wednesday Wire. Today, like we said, Marcus Jones joins us live in the studio, and we've had Alan Blackman for the past few weeks, but we finally got Marcus live, which is exciting. How are you doing?
Oh, this is weird.
Yeah.
I've been here for months, so this is a nice change, though.
It's exciting, and I'll tell you guys something really embarrassing. When Marcus showed up to the door, I didn't even recognize him because I've been speaking to him on the phone so much, and I could not match his voice to what he looks like. But anyway, we've got some exciting stuff today. So first of all, we talk about how Omicron affects children. So children are making up a big proportion of people that have been hospitalized with COVID than in previous infection waves such as Delta or the original strain. So what exactly is going on there?
Yeah, so this is particularly topical to many Kiwis at the moment because there is a large number of unvaccinated preschoolers who are in kindy, and a pretty large number of, you know, 5 to 11 year olds who are in primary school, and many of those don't have vaccines yet, right, even though they're available. So this is topical since Omicron is now sort of working its way around New Zealand. What's happened is that, you know, as Omicron has sort of swept the globe in the past 2 or 3 months, millions of people have indeed been hospitalized, and children have been no exception. For example, in the United States, they've made up a larger proportion of COVID-19 hospitalizations than at any time of the pandemic. And that might be concerning, but it seems like the individual risk of a child with Omicron being hospitalized is actually lower by about a third to a half than it was with the Delta variant. Wow. What's probably better is that children who are hospitalized are not presenting with any more severe illness than they were with the other variants. These findings mirror the trend in the general population. Omicron seems less likely than Delta to cause hospitalizations or death, especially in immunized and younger populations. But scientists are still trying to work out why. So in the U.S., for example, children make up about 5% of all COVID-19 hospitalizations, and that's up about 4 times higher than previous coronavirus waves. One potential explanation is this variant is highly transmissible. When that's coupled to a lack of built-up immunity from vaccination or past infections, that leaves children more vulnerable to Omicron.
So is this a case of the vaccine rollout for children is lagging behind a little bit, and also it's just a higher rate of infection anyway?
Yeah, I think it's also that the vaccines are not targeting Omicron as well as they did the other variants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
And so if that's the big-time variant, then that's what's... Yeah.
Yeah, and it's swept around so quickly that it seems to be so much more infectious that we're still playing catch-up. Yeah. And it's certainly less likely to cause severe illness in all age groups. Another possible explanation is that... Omicron, it seems to not infect lung cells as readily as cells in the upper airways, unlike the other variants. In general, the lungs are where the coronavirus does most of its damage, and so there are fewer infected lung cells could mean less severe illness, but children have relatively small nasal passageways, can easily be blocked, so pediatric upper respiratory infections sometimes need extra attention compared with those with adults. And then the final thing is, even if children generally recover from acute infections with Omicron, clinicians are still worried that they may develop long COVID, in which symptoms persist for months or longer, or a rare but serious condition called multisystem inflammatory syndrome, I think that's what I meant to write.
Bit of a mouthful.
In children, yeah. It's too early to assess the effect of Omicron of long COVID symptoms in children, but the MIS, multisystem inflammatory syndrome, symptoms usually developed 2 to 4 weeks after infection. So there's still a lot to think about and worry about with this new variant, yeah, especially in children.
I feel like that's just sort of the general vibe, isn't it, with, you know, COVID, that it is sort of just waiting to to see.
Yeah, we can't really get a grasp on it because things are changing so quickly.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, that's definitely concerning, and also concerning, which is a bit of a bummer for today, but scientists are concerned that atmospheric methane levels are rising quicker than we expected. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so there's no good news today, I'm sorry. So global methane concentrations. So most of what we hear about in terms of global warming is in relation to carbon dioxide, CO2. Mm. But methane is also a greenhouse gas, and it is more potent than CO2 in terms of trapping heat. And it's reached 1,900 parts per billion. That doesn't really tell you much, but it's nearly triple pre-industrial levels. So three times higher than what we think was in the atmosphere 200 years ago. Yeah. And that's not a great milestone. But it's not clear exactly where that methane is coming from. So methane is a greenhouse gas. It's at least 28 times as potent as CO2.
And I think in layman's terms, like, I guess the general knowledge is that people expect it comes from cows in the agriculture sector.
That's one source, yeah. That's one source. But there could be others. In fact, there are definitely others. It's just assigning what is the most potent source.
Right.
So more than a decade, scientists have deployed aircraft and all sorts of satellite measurements and things, and to try and understand the drivers of the increase in methane. Potential explanations range from expanding exploitation of oil and gas, rising emissions from landfills, and growing livestock herds. So that's the cows. Also, increasing activity by bacteria in wetlands. That's another major source of methane.
Oh, interesting.
And which of those is dominating is actually a difficult thing to figure out. So one clue is in the isotopic signature of methane molecules. So bear with me. The majority of carbon is called carbon-12.
Mm-hmm.
But methane molecules sometimes also contain a heavier form of carbon, a heavier isotope of carbon called carbon-13.
Mm-hmm.
Now, methane generated by bacteria after they've consumed carbon, let's say in the mud of a wetland or in the gut of a cow, for instance, contain less carbon-13 than does methane generated by heat and pressure inside the earth, which is released during fossil fuel extraction. So by figuring out the ratio of carbon-12 and 13, they can maybe get a grip on, you know, where the carbon is coming from, where the methane is coming from.
Of course.
By studying methane trapped decades or centuries ago in ice cores, you can figure out what the historical proportions were. But since 2007, when methane levels began to rise more rapidly, the proportion of methane containing carbon-13 began to fall. And some researchers believe that this suggests that much of the increase in the past 15 years might be due to bacterial sources rather than the extraction of fossil food. So that's bacteria in the gut of cows or in wetlands or whatever.
Okay. So what are we looking at in terms of solutions if it's more about bacteria than an industry source?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next step is to sort of try and pin down the relative contributions of microbes from various different systems,
right,
such as wetlands or human-raised livestock or human-raised livestock or landfills. And that may help to determine whether the warming itself is contributed to the whether warming itself is contributing to the increase, because there is this feedback that as we warm, we change the wetlands and we change the amount of methane that is coming from these bacteria. So it's sort of it's a feedback thing. So
more.
And that creates more methane.
Wow.
So it's a complicated system. it means that there's plenty that can be done to reduce emissions. In the COP26 in Glasgow last year, more than 100 countries signed the Global Methane Pledge to cut emissions by 30% from 2020 levels by 2030. Scientists are really saying the emphasis must be now on action, including low and middle income countries across the global south.
Wow. I mean, we've been saying it for decades, but hopefully this is the wake-up call that we need and we actually take action on.
That's right.
And finally, this one's quite interesting. It's kind of almost man versus machine. So astronomers are struggling a little bit to see the night sky because of how many satellites are now orbiting the globe, right? So how are they kind of leading this fight? I don't even know how to explain
it. As far as astronomers ever fight, but so there's in the last few years, various companies have put up thousands of little satellites that are trying to provide sort of global internet. So two broadband projects. Elon Musk's Starlink network,
of course,
and one based in the UK called OneWeb. They're leading the sort of the new wave of constellations. These are constellations of satellites. So between them, they've launched over 2,000 satellites, and both have plans for many thousands more. Yeah.
And is it, I don't know whether anybody can confirm this for me, but can you just put a satellite up in space and not have to pay anybody or do anything? You can just go, cool, I'm gonna do that, and that's fine. How does it work? Do we know?
I don't really know. But
does
I don't
anybody
think...
know? If you're listening and you know what the laws are around putting a satellite in space, do let us know, because I'm intrigued.
Send us a text.
Yeah, I'm like, is it costing Elon Musk anything to throw? Like, obviously, you know, it
does
is
it
to
matter?
Have it moving. Like, well, I don't know. So yes, anyway.
I think probably regulation is lagging.
Yes, I would say so, because my own,
If that's why we have 2,000 plus satellites like being launched in one go, which is pretty crazy.
Totally.
Well, the problem is someone forgot to tell the astronomers that they were doing this.
Right.
And all of these thousands of satellites are making leaving bright streaks across all their telescope images.
Because they're moving in the star.
So if you you're looking at a far distant whatever in space, and you're leaving your camera open for a while, and then these satellites sort of streak bright images across your field of view, then
how annoying.
Potentially it's ruined.
So what are they doing to do like combat that?
So the International Astronomical Union is establishing a new center to focus the community's response. So there's a lot of angry astronomers, and they're getting together and making a response, and it's led by the U.S. National Optical Infrared Astronomy Research Lab in Tucson, Arizona, and by the Square Kilometer Array in the UK. And the latter one is actually most concerned with the satellite's effect on radio astronomy, because all these satellites put out radio signals as well, and they swamp all the radio astronomy pictures as well that we measure. And this new center is trying to act as a single voice for astronomy. So it will engage with and encourage satellite companies to make every effort to minimize the light pollution they're creating. And they're also trying to pursue policy around the world to tighten the regulations on what is acceptable behavior in orbit.
Right.
So that, you know, there's things that they can do. They can make satellites just darker, so they're not shining lights quite so much. They can limit the radio emissions. So for example, an example of the problems caused by these satellites. So you may have heard of something called the cosmic microwave background, which is the radio frequency remnants of the Big Bang. This is one of the things we used to discover and understand what happened, you know, 13 billion plus years ago. It's the oldest light in the sky, and it gives us a glimpse of the structure and the contents of the universe shortly after the Big Bang.
The detectors
that detected that would be blinded by the downlinks from these constellations of satellites. In this field, then we would effectively be blind to...
We couldn't study what the universe was like shortly.
To that, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the end of the decade, more than 5,000 satellites will be above the horizon at any given time, at any typical dark sky observation location. So it's a 5,000 in the sky above your head, and a few hundred to several thousands of these satellites will be illuminated by the sun. So those are the ones that produce bright streaks. So it's
amazing.
It's a big problem, and more than just an annoyance for astronomers, it's actually could interfere with some, you know, really useful measurements. Another example is understanding near-Earth objects, so things that could potentially hit the Earth and wipe us out, appear as streaks in the sky. And if you've got streaks in the sky
on
top of streaks in the sky, it's very difficult to spot.
Definitely a problem. And that is, well, dear science for today, a bit of a downer.
It's okay. It's important stuff.
It is important stuff, and it is always exciting to learn more about the world as it is today. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Marcus.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.